the time I arrive. It's very long, she reminded him. Then I'll have to drive slowly. When Andrew appeared on the Chelsea doorstep, he was greeted by Alison in a housecoat, her newly dry hair falling down well below shoulder level. The victor come to claim his spoils. No, only last night's coffee, he said. But won't that keep you awake? I certainly hope so. By the time Andrew left Alison's home at 8 the next morning, he had already decided he wanted to see a lot more of Hugh Mackenzie's daughter. He returned to his own flat in Cheyne Walk, showered and changed before making breakfast for himself and going over his mail. There were several more messages of congratulations, including one from the Secretary of State for Scotland, while the Times and the Guardian carried brief but favourable comments. Before leaving for the Commons, Andrew checked over an amendment he wanted to move in committee that morning. When he had reworded his effort several times, he picked up his papers and headed off towards Westminster. Arriving a little early for the 10:30 committee meeting, Andrew found time to collect his mail from the members' post office just off the central lobby. He set off, head down along the corridor towards the library, flicking through the envelopes to see if he recognised any familiar hand or official-looking missive that demanded to be opened immediately. As he turned the corner, he was surprised to find the House ticker tape machine surrounded by Conservative members, including the man who had agreed to be his pair for voting purposes. Andrew stared up at the tall figure of Charles Seymour, who, although standing on the fringe of the crowd, still found it possible to read the tapped-out message on the telex machine. "What's causing so much interest?" he asked, prodding Seymour's elbow. "Sir Alec has just announced the timetable that will be followed when we select the new Tory leader." "We all await with bated breath," said Andrew. "As well you might," said Charles, ignoring the sarcasm. "Since the next announcement will undoubtedly be his resignation. Then the real politics will begin." "Be sure you back the winner," said Andrew, grinning. Charles Seymour smiled knowingly, but made no comment. Chapter 3 Charles Seymour drove his Daimler from the Commons to his father's bank in the city. He still thought of Seymour's of Cheapside as his father's bank, although for two generations the family had been only minority shareholders, with Charles himself in possession of a mere 2% of the stock. Nevertheless, as his brother Rupert showed no desire in representing the family interests, the 2% guaranteed Charles a place on the board and an income sufficient to ensure that his paltry parliamentary salary of £1,750 a year was adequately supplemented. From the day Charles had first taken his place on the board of Seymour's, he had no doubt that the new chairman, Derek Spencer, considered him a dangerous rival. Spencer had lobbied to have Rupert replace his father on retirement, and only because of Charles's insistence had Spencer failed to move the old Earl to his way of thinking. When Charles went on to take his seat in Parliament, Spencer at once raised the problem of his burdensome responsibilities at the House, preventing him from carrying out his day-to-day duties for the board. However, Charles was able to convince a majority of his fellow directors of the advantages of having someone on the board at Westminster, although he knew that that would cease if he was ever invited to be a minister. As Charles left the Daimler in Seymour's courtyard, it amused him to consider that his parking space was worth 20 times the value of the car. The area at the front of Seymour's was a relic of his great-grandfather's day. The 12th Earl of Bridgewater had insisted on an entrance large enough to allow a complete sweep for his coach and four. That conveyance had long disappeared, to be replaced by 12 car spaces for Seymour directors. The bank's new management-conscious chairman, despite all his grammar school virtues, had never suggested the land be used for any other purpose. The young girl, seated at the reception desk, abruptly stopped polishing her nails in time to say, "Good morning, Mr. Charles. as he came through the revolving doors and disappeared into a waiting lift. A few moments later, Charles was seated behind a desk in his small oak-paneled office, a clean white memo pad in front of him. He pressed a button on the intercom and told his secretary that he did not want to be disturbed during the next hour. 60 minutes later, the white pad had 12 names penciled on it, but 10 already had lines drawn through them. Only the names of Reginald Maudling and Edward Heath remained. Charles tore off the piece of paper and the indented sheet underneath and put them both through the shredder by the side of his desk. He tried to summon up some interest in the agenda for the bank's weekly board meeting. Only one item, item 7, seemed to be of any importance. Just before 11, he gathered up his papers and headed towards the boardroom. Most of his colleagues were already seated when Derek Spencer called item number 1 as the boardroom clock chimed the hour. During the ensuing predictable discussion on bank rates, the movement in metal prices, eurobonds, and client investment policy, Charles's mind kept wandering back to the forthcoming leadership election and the importance of backing the winner if he were to be quickly promoted from the back benches. By the time they'd reached item 7 on the agenda, Charles had made up his mind. Derek Spencer opened a discussion on the proposed loans to Mexico and Poland, and most of the board members agreed with him that the bank should participate in one, but not risk both. Charles's thoughts, however, were not in Mexico City or Warsaw. They were far nearer home, and when the chairman called for a vote, Charles didn't register. Mexico or Poland, Charles? Which of the two do you favor? Heath, he replied. I beg your pardon, said Derek Spencer. Charles snapped back from Westminster to Cheapside, to find everyone around the boardroom table staring at him. With the air of a man who'd been giving the matter considerable thought, Charles said firmly, Mexico, and added, The great difference between the two countries can best be gauged by their attitudes to repayment. Mexico might not want to repay, but Poland won't be able to. So why not limit our risks and back Mexico? If it comes to litigation, I'd prefer to be against someone who won't pay rather than someone who can't. The older members round the table nodded in agreement. The right son of Bridgewater was sitting on the board. When the meeting was over, Charles joined his colleagues for lunch in the director's dining room. On the walls hung 2 Hogarths, a Bruegel, a Goya, and a Rembrandt that could distract even the most indulgent gourmet. Just another reminder of his great-grandfather's ability to select winners. Charles did not wait to make a decision between the Cheddar and the Stilton, as he wanted to be back in the Commons for question time. On arrival at the house, he immediately made his way to the smoking room, long regarded by the Tories as their preserve. There, in the deep leather armchairs and cigar-laden atmosphere, the talk was entirely of who would be Sir Alec's successor. Charles could not avoid overhearing Pimpkin's high-pitched voice.
As Edward Heath is Shadow Chancellor, while we debate the finance bill on the floor of the House, it is he who is bound to be the centre of attention.
Later that afternoon, Charles returned to the Commons chamber. He wanted to observe Heath and his shadow team deal with the government's amendments one by one. He was about to leave the chamber when Raymond Gould rose to move an amendment. Charles listened with grudging admiration, as Raymond's intellectual grasp and force of argument easily compensated for his lack of oratorial skill. Although Gould was a cut above the rest of his intake on the Labour benches, he didn't frighten Charles. 12 generations of shrewd business acumen had kept large parts of Leeds in the hands of the Bridgewater family, without the likes of Raymond Gould even being aware of it. Charles took supper in the members' dining room that night, and sat at the large table in the centre of the room, frequented by Tory backbenchers. There was only one topic of conversation, and as the same 2 names kept emerging, it was obvious that it was going to be a very close-run thing. When Charles arrived back at his Eaton Square home after the 10 o'clock division, Fiona was already tucked up in bed, reading Philip Larkin's The Wits and Weddings. "They let you out early tonight?"
"Not too bad,"
said Charles, and began regaling her with how he'd spent his day before disappearing into the bathroom. If Charles imagined he was cunning, his wife, Lady Fiona, only daughter of the Duke of Falkirk, was in a different league. She and Charles had been selected for each other at an early age, and neither had questioned or doubted the wisdom of the choice. Although Charles had squired numerous girlfriends before their marriage in between, he had always assumed he would return to Fiona. Charles's grandfather always maintained that the aristocracy was becoming far too lax and sentimental about marriage.
"Women," he declared, "are for bearing children and ensuring a continuation of the male line."
The old Earl became even more staid in his convictions when he was made aware that Rupert showed little interest in the opposite sex and was rarely to be found in the company of women. Fiona would never have dreamed of disagreeing with the old man to his face, as she was determined that it would be a son of hers that would inherit the earldom. But despite enthusiastic and then contrived efforts, Charles seemed unable to sire an heir. Fiona was later assured by a Harley Street physician that there was no reason she could not bear children. The specialist had suggested that perhaps her husband pay the clinic a visit. She shook her head, knowing Charles would dismiss such an idea out of hand, and never mention the subject to anyone again. Fiona spent a considerable amount of her spare time in their Sussex Downs constituency, furthering Charles's political career. She had learned to live with the fact that theirs was not destined to be a romantic marriage, and resigned herself to its other advantages. Although many men confessed covertly and overtly that they found the tall, elegant lady desirable, she either ignored their overtures or pretended not to notice them. By the time Charles returned from the bathroom in his blue silk pajamas, Fiona had formed a plan, but first she needed some questions answered.
"Whom do you favour?"
"I'd like Sir Alec to carry on. After all, the Humes have been friends of our two families for over 400 years.
"But that's a non-starter," said Fiona. "Everyone knows Alec is on the way out."
"I agree, and that's exactly why I spent the entire afternoon observing the worthwhile candidates."
"Did you come to any serious conclusions?"
Fiona asked.
"Heath and Maudling are out on their own, though, to be honest, I've never had a conversation with either of them that lasted for more than 5 minutes.
"In that case, we must turn a disadvantage into an advantage."
"What do you mean, old girl?"
Charles asked, as he climbed into bed beside his wife.
"Think back. When you were president of Pop at Eton, could you have put a name to any of the first-year boys?"
"Certainly not," said Charles.
"Exactly. And I'd be willing to bet that neither Heath nor Magdalen could put a name to 20 of the new intake on the Tory benches."
"Where are you leading me, Lady Macbeth?"
"No bloody hands will be needed for this killing. Simply, having chosen your Duncan, you volunteer to organise the new intake for him. If he becomes leader, he's bound to feel it would be appropriate to select one or two new faces for his team."
"You could be right."
"Well, let's sleep on it,"
said Fiona, turning out the light on her side of the bed. Charles didn't sleep on it, but lay restless most of the night, turning over in his mind what she'd said. When Fiona awoke the next morning, she carried on the conversation as if there'd been no break in between.
"Do you have to be rushed into a decision?"
"No, but if I let it drift, I could be accused of jumping on the bandwagon, and then I would have lost my chance to be seen as a leader among the new intake."
"Better still," she continued, "before the man you choose announces he is a candidate, demand that he stand on behalf of the new members."
"Clever," said Charles.
"Whom have you decided on?"
"Heath,"
Charles replied without hesitation.
"I'll back your political judgment," said Fiona. "Just trust me when it comes to tactics. First,
we compose a letter. In dressing gowns on the floor at the end of the bed, the two elegant figures drafted and redrafted a note to Edward Heath. At 9:30, it was finally composed and sent round by hand to his rooms in Albany. The next morning, Charles was invited to the small bachelor flat for coffee. They talked for over an hour, and later, as the two men stood below a Piper landscape in the drawing-room, the deal was struck. Charles thought Sir Alec would announce his resignation in the late summer, which would give him 8 to 10 weeks to carry out a campaign. Fiona typed out a list of all the new members, and during the next 8 weeks, every one of them was invited to their Eaton Square flat for drinks. Fiona was subtle enough to see that members of the lower house were outnumbered by other guests, often from the House of Lords. Heath managed to escape from his front bench duties on the finance bill to spend at least an hour with the Seymours once a week. As the day of Sir Alec Douglas Hume's resignation drew nearer, Charles realized the leadership result could be almost as important to him as it would be to Heath. But he also remained confident that he had carried out his plan in a subtle and discreet way. He would have been willing to place a wager that no one, other than Edward Heath, had worked out how deeply he was involved. One man who attended the second of Fiona's soirees saw exactly what was going on. While many of the guests spent their time admiring the Seymour art collection, Simon Carslake kept a wary eye on his host and hostess. Carslake was not convinced that Edward Heath would win the forthcoming election, and felt confident that Reginald Maudlin would turn out to be the party's natural choice. Maudlin was, after all, Shadow Foreign Secretary, a former Chancellor and far senior to Heath. More important, he was a married man. Simon doubted the Tories would ever pick a bachelor to lead them. As soon as Carslake had left the Seymours, he jumped into a taxi and returned immediately to the Commons. He found Reginald Maudlin in the members' dining room, seated at the table frequented only by the Shadow Cabinet. He waited until Maudlin had finished his meal before asking if they could have a few moments alone. The tall, shambling figure, not altogether certain of the name of the new member, leaned over and invited Simon to join him for a drink in his room. Maudlin listened intently to all the enthusiastic young man had to say, and accepted the judgment of the well-informed member without question. It was agreed that Simon should try to counter the Seymour campaign and report back his results twice a week. While Seymour could call on all the powers and influence of his Etonian background, Carslake could rely on the knowledge and arm-twisting skills gained from his time as president of the Oxford Union. Simon weighed up the advantages and disadvantages he possessed. He did not own a palatial home in Eaton Square, in which Turners, Constables, and Holbeins were not to be found in books, but on the walls. He also lacked a glamorous society wife. Simon lived in a small house in Beaufort Street in Chelsea, and Elizabeth was a gynecologist at St. Mary's Hospital, Paddington. Although Elizabeth gave Simon's political aspirations her full backing, she still considered her own career every bit as important, an opinion with which Simon concurred. The local Coventry press had on several occasions recalled in their columns how Elizabeth had left her 3-day-old child to help perform a cesarean section on a mother in the adjoining ward, and 2 years later had to be dragged off night duty just as she went into labour with their second child. This independence of character was one of the reasons Simon had admired Elizabeth when they first met, but he realized she was no match for Lady Fiona Seymour as a hostess, and he never wanted her to be. He despised pushy political wives. Simon spent the following days trying to work out the certain Maudlin and certain Heath supporters, although many members claimed they would favor both candidates according to who asked them. These he listed as doubtfuls. When Enoch Powell threw his cap into the ring, Simon could not find a single new member other than Alec Pimpkin who openly supported him. That left 40 members from the new intake who still had to be followed up. He estimated 12 certain Heath, 11 certain Maudling, and 1 Powell, leaving 16 undecided. As the day of the election drew nearer, it became obvious that few of the remaining 16 actually knew either candidate well, and were still not sure for whom they should vote. Simon realized that he could not invite them all round to Beaufort Street, between Elizabeth's ward duties, so he would have to go to them. During the last 8 weeks, he accompanied his chosen leader as he addressed the party faithfuls in 23 new members' constituencies. Simon travelled from Bodmin to Glasgow, from Penrith to Great Yarmouth, briefing Magdalen studiously before every meeting. Gradually, it became obvious to everyone that Charles Seymour and Simon Carslake were the chosen lieutenants among the new intake. Some members resented the whispered confidences at the Eaton Square cocktail parties, or the discovery that Simon Carslake had visited their constituencies under false pretenses, while others were simply envious of the reward that would inevitably be heaped on the victor. "But why do you support Magdalen?" Elizabeth had asked him one evening over dinner. "Reggie has a great deal more experience of government than Heath, and in any case he's more caring about those around him."
"But Heath appears to be so much more professional," Elizabeth insisted, pouring her husband a glass of wine.
"That may well be the case, but the British have always preferred good amateurs to preside over their affairs."
"If you believe all that stuff about amateurs, why become so involved yourself?"
Simon considered her question for some time before answering. "Because I don't come from the type of background that automatically commands the center of the Tory stage," he admitted.
"Neither does Heath," commented Elizabeth dryly.
Although everyone inside and outside of Parliament knew it could not be long before Sir Alec formally announced his resignation, it did not become official until July the 22nd, 1965, when he addressed the 1922 Committee of Tory Backbenchers. The date chosen for the leadership election was just 5 days later. During that time, Simon Carslake and Charles Seymour worked almost round the clock, but despite many national papers commissioned polls, columns of newsprint offering statistics and opinions, no one seemed certain of the outcome, other than to predict that Powell would come third. Charles and Simon began avoiding each other, and Fiona started referring to Carslake, first in private, then in public, as that pushy self-made man. She stopped using the expression when Alec Pimpkin asked in all innocence whether she was referring to Edward Heath. On the morning of the secret ballot, Simon and Charles voted early, and spent the rest of the day pacing the corridors of the Commons, trying to assess the result. By lunchtime, they were both outwardly exuberant, while inwardly despondent. At 2:15, they were seated in the large committee room to hear the chairman of the 1922 committee make the historic announcement.
"The result of the first election for leader of the Conservative Parliamentary Party," said Sir William Anstruther Grey, "is as follows. Edward Heath, 150 votes. Reginald Magdalen, 133 votes. Enoch Powell, 15 votes."
An hour later, Reginald Magdalen, who had been lunching in the city, telephoned Heath to say he would be happy to serve under him as the new leader. Charles and Fiona opened a bottle of Krug, while Simon took Elizabeth to the Old Vic to see the Royal Hunt of the Sun. He slept the entire way through Robert Stephen's brilliant performance before Elizabeth drove him home.
"How come you didn't fall asleep? After all, you've been just as busy as I have the last few weeks," Simon asked.
Elizabeth smiled. "It was my turn to want to be involved with what was happening on the center of the stage." 2 weeks later, on the 4th of August, Edward Heath announced his shadow team. Reggie Magdalen was to be deputy leader. Sir Alec accepted the Foreign Office brief, while Powell went to defense. Charles Seymour received an invitation to join the housing and local government team as its junior spokesman, thus becoming the first of the new intake to be given front bench responsibilities.
Simon Karslake received a handwritten letter from Reggie Maudling thanking him for his valiant efforts.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 1 of First Among Equals. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 2. First Among Equals, Cassette 2.
Book 2, 1966 to 1974, Junior Office. Chapter 4. When Alison Mackenzie moved into Andrew Fraser's Cheney Walk flat, everyone, including her father, the Minister of State for Scotland, assumed they would soon announce their engagement. For the previous 3 months, Andrew had had his head down in committee, helping out with the public bills relating exclusively to Scotland, which were referred to the committee from the House itself. He found much of the committee work boring, as so many members repeated the views of their colleagues less and less articulately, and for some time only his doodling improved. Even so, Andrew's energy and charm made him a popular companion through the long summer months, and he quickly gained enough confidence to suggest first minor and later major changes to amendments considered by the committee. The disparity between penalties under English and Scottish law had long worried him, and he pressed hard for changes that would bring the two systems closer together. He soon discovered that the Scottish Labour members were more traditional and clannish than even the most hidebound of Tories. When the session came to an end, Andrew invited Alison to spend a long weekend with his parents at their country home in Stirling at the end of the recess. "Do you expect me to sleep under the same roof as a former Conservative Lord Provost of Edinburgh?" she demanded. "Why not? You've been sleeping with his son for the past 6 months." "Well, the same roof, perhaps, but there's one weekend we won't be able to sleep in the same bed." "Why not? The Tories may be snobs, but they're not hypocrites." Alison didn't want to admit that she was actually quite nervous about spending the weekend with Andrew's father, as she had heard him continually maligned at her parents' breakfast table for over 20 years. When she did meet old Dungheap, as her father referred to the former Lord Provost, Alison liked him immediately. He reminded her so much of her own father, while Lady Fraser was not at all the snobbish little battle-axe her mother had prepared her for. It was immediately agreed that during the weekend nobody would talk politics. Andrew and Alison spent most of the Friday afternoon walking through the heather-covered hills and discussing in detail how they saw their future. On the Saturday morning, the minister telephoned Sir Duncan and invited them over to Bute House, the official residence of the Secretary of State for Scotland, for dinner. After so many years of opposing each other, both families were nervous of the social get-together, but it seemed the children were to bridge the political gap they had failed to build for themselves. The Mackenzies had invited two other Edinburgh families to dinner in the hope that it would ease the tension of the occasion. A branch of the Forsyths, who owned the departmental store in Prince's Street, and the Menges, who ran the largest chain of newsagents in the country. Andrew had decided to use the gathering to make an announcement at the end of dinner, and having spent longer shopping than he originally intended, was the last to arrive at Bute House. After they'd all found their place cards around the long dining room table, the 14 guests remained silent as a lone piper played a lament before the chef entered carrying a silver salver which bore on it a large haggis for the minister's inspection. Sir Duncan's opinion was sought. "Warm, reeking rich," he declared. It was the first occasion the two men had wholeheartedly agreed on anything. Andrew did not eat as much as the others, because he couldn't take his eyes off the guest who had been placed opposite him. She didn't pay much attention to Andrew, but seemed always to be smiling or laughing, making those around her enjoy her company. When Andrew had last seen Louise Forsyth, it had been scoring goals on a hockey pitch. She had been a dumpy little girl with long pigtails and the tendency to go for one's ankles rather than for the ball. Now the jet black hair was short and curly, while the body had become slim and graceful. After dinner, Andrew mixed among the guests, and it was well after 1 o'clock when the party broke up. He never managed a moment alone with her. Andrew was relieved to discover that Alison wanted to spend the night with her parents at Butte House, while the Frasers travelled back to their home in Stirling.
"You're very silent for a socialist," his father said in the car on the way home.
"He's in love," his mother said fondly. Andrew made no reply. The next morning, he rose early and travelled into Edinburgh to see his agent. The minister had caught the first flight back to London, but had left a message asking if Andrew would be kind enough to see him at 10 o'clock in Dover House, the London headquarters of the Scottish office, the following day, on an official matter. Andrew was delighted, but it didn't change his attitude. Having answered his local post and dealt with some constituents' problems, he left his office and made his way over to the new club to make a private phone call. He was relieved to find her still at home. She reluctantly agreed to join him for lunch. Andrew sat alone for 40 minutes, checking the grandfather clock every few moments while pretending to read the Scotsman. When she was eventually ushered in by the steward, Andrew knew this was the woman with whom he wanted to spend the rest of his life. He would have laughed if he had been told, before the previous evening, that he could change his well-ordered plans on what was nothing more than a casual meeting. But then, he had never met anyone like Louise before, and was already convinced he never would again.
"Miss Forsyth," said the man wearing the green livery uniform of the club. He inclined his head slightly and left them alone. Louise smiled, and Andrew guided her to a table in the corner.
"It was kind of you to come at such short notice," he said nervously.
"No," she said. "It was very stupid of me."
Over a lunch, which he ordered but didn't eat, Andrew learned that Louise Forsyth was engaged to an old friend of his from university days, and that they planned to be married the following spring. By the end of lunch, he had convinced her they should at least meet again. Andrew caught the 5:10 flight back to London and sat alone in his flat and waited. Alison returned a little after 9 o'clock and asked why he hadn't travelled down from Scotland with her, or at least phoned. Andrew immediately told her the truth. She burst into tears while he stood helplessly by. Within the hour, she had moved all her possessions out of Andrew's flat and left. At 10:30, he phoned Louise again. The next morning, Andrew dropped into the Commons to collect his mail from the members' post office and to check with the Whip's office as to what time they were anticipating the votes that day.
1 at 6 and 2 at 10, shouted a junior whip from behind his desk. And we could lose the second, so be certain you're not far away if we need you.
Andrew nodded and turned to leave.
By the way, congratulations.
On what? Queried Andrew.
Oh, hell, another indiscretion to start the week on. It's penciled in on the morning sheet, said the whip, tapping a piece of paper in front of him.
What is? Asked Andrew impatiently.
Your appointment as Parliamentary Private Secretary to Hugh Mackenzie. For pity's sake, don't let him know I told you.
I won't, promised Andrew, breathing a sigh of relief. He checked his watch. Perfect timing to stroll over to Dover House and keep his appointment with the minister.
He whistled as he walked down Whitehall, and the doorman saluted as he entered the ministry. They had obviously been briefed as well. He tried not to show too much anticipation. He was met at the top of the stone steps by the minister's secretary.
Good morning, Andrew said, trying to sound as if he had no idea what was in store for him.
Good morning, Mr. Frasier, replied the secretary. The minister has asked me to apologize for not being available to see you, But he's been called away to a cabinet committee to discuss the new IMF standby credit.
I see, said Andrew.
Has the minister rearranged my appointment?
Well, no, he hasn't,
replied the secretary, sounding a little surprised. He simply said that it was no longer important, and he was sorry to have wasted your time.
Charles Seymour was enjoying the challenge of his new appointment as a junior opposition spokesman. Even if he was not actually making decisions on future policy, he was listening to them, and at least he felt he was near the center of affairs. Whenever a debate on housing took place in the Commons, he was allowed to sit on the front bench along with the rest of the team. He had already caused the defeat of two amendments on the Town and Country Planning Bill in Standing Committee, and had added one of his own, relating to the protection of trees, during the report stage of the bill on the floor of the House.
It isn't preventing a world war, he admitted to Fiona, but in its own way it's quite important, because if we win the election, I'm confident of being offered junior office, and then I'll have a real chance to shape policy.
Fiona continued to play her part, hosting monthly dinner parties at their Eaton Square house. By the end of the year, every member of the Shadow Cabinet had dined with the Seymours at least once, and Fiona never wore the same dress twice or allowed a menu to be repeated. When the parliamentary year began again in October, Charles was one of the names continually dropped by the political pundits. Here was someone to watch. He makes things happen, was the sentiment that was expressed again and again. He could barely cross the members' lobby without a correspondent trying to solicit his views on everything from butter mountains to rape. Fiona cut out of the newspapers every mention of her husband, and couldn't help noticing that if any new member was receiving more press coverage than Charles, it was a young socialist from Leeds called Raymond Gould. Raymond's name began to disappear from political columns soon after his success on the budget debate. His colleagues assumed it was because he was busy building a career at the bar. Had they passed his room at the Temple, they would have heard the continual tap of a typewriter and been unable to contact him on his off-the-hook phone. Each night, Raymond could be found in chambers, writing page after page, checking, then rechecking his proofs, and often referring to the piles of books that cluttered his desk. When his full employment at any cost, Reflections of a Worker Educated After the 30s, was published, it caused an immediate sensation. The suggestion that the unions would become impotent and that the Labour Party would need to be more radical to capture the young vote was never likely to endear him to the party activists. Raymond had anticipated that it would provoke a storm of abuse from union leaders, and even among some of his more left-wing colleagues. But AJP Taylor suggested in the Times that it was the most profound and realistic look at the Labour Party since Anthony Crossland's The Future of Socialism, and had given the country a politician of rare honesty and courage. Raymond soon became aware that his strategy and hard work was paying dividends. He found himself a regular topic of conversation at political dinner parties in London. Joyce thought the book a magnificent piece of scholarship, and she spent a considerable time trying to convince trade unionists who had only read out-of-context quotations from it in The Sun or Daily Mirror that it in fact showed a passionate concern for the trade union movement, while at the same time realistically considering the Labour Party's future in the next decade. The Labour chief whip took Raymond on one side and told him,
"You've caused quite a stir, lad. Now keep your head down for a few months, and you'll probably find every cabinet member quoting you as if it were party policy."
Raymond took the chief whip's advice, but he did not have to wait months. Just 3 weeks after the book's publication, the Prime Minister quoted a whole passage at the Durham Miners' Rally. A few weeks later, Raymond received a missive from Number 10 requesting him to check over the Prime Minister's speech to the TUC conference and add any suggestions he might have. Simon Carslake had sulked for about 24 hours after Maudling's defeat for the leadership. He then decided to turn his anger and energy towards the government benches.
It hadn't taken him long to work out that there was a 15-minute period twice a week when someone with his skills of oratory could command notice. At the beginning of a new session each week, he would carefully study the order paper, and in particular the first 5 questions listed for the Prime Minister on the Tuesday and Thursday. Every Monday morning, he would prepare a supplementary for at least 3 of them. These he worded, then reworded, so that they were biting and witty and always likely to embarrass the government. Although preparation of such supplementary questions could take several hours, Simon would make them sound as though they'd been jotted down on the back of the order paper during question time, and in fact, would even do so. Elizabeth teased him about how long he took on something she considered trivial. He reminded her of Churchill's comment after being praised for a brilliant rejoinder. All my best off-the-cuff remarks had been worked on days before. Even so, Simon was surprised at how quickly the House took it for granted that he would be there on the attack, probing, demanding, harrying the Prime Minister's every move. Whenever he rose from his seat, the party perked up in anticipation, and many of his interruptions reached the political column of the daily newspapers the following day. Unemployment was the subject of that day's question. Simon was on his feet, leaning forward, jabbing a finger in the direction of the government front bench. With the appointment of 4 extra secretaries of state this week, the Prime Minister can at least claim he has full employment in the cabinet. The Prime Minister sank lower into his seat, looking forward to the recess. Chapter 5. When the Queen opened Parliament, the talk was not of the contents of her speech, which traditionally list the aims of the government of the day, but of how much of the legislation could possibly be carried out while the Labour Party retained a majority of only 4. Any contentious legislation was likely to be defeated at the committee stage, and everyone knew it. The Conservatives were convinced they could win the forthcoming election, whatever date the Prime Minister chose. Until the by-election held in Hull increased the Labour majority from 1,100 to 5,350. The Prime Minister couldn't believe the result and asked the Queen to dissolve Parliament immediately and to call a general election. The date announced from Buckingham Palace was March the 31st. Simon Karslake began spending most of his spare time in his Coventry constituency. The local people seemed pleased with the apprenticeship of their new member, but the disinterested statisticians pointed out that a swing of less than 1% would remove him from the House for another 5 years. By then, his rivals would be on the second rung of the ladder. The Tory chief whip advised Simon to stay put in Coventry and not to participate in any further parliamentary business.
"There'll be no more 3-line whips between now and the election," he assured him. "The most worthwhile thing you can do is pick up votes in Coventry, not give them in Westminster."
Elizabeth could only manage 2 weeks' leave of absence from St. Mary's, and yet, between the two of them, they covered the entire constituency before Election Day. Simon's opponent was the former member Alf Abbott, who became progressively confident of victory as the national swing to Labour accelerated during the campaign. The slogan, "You know Labour government works," was sounding convincing after only 18 months in power. The Liberals fielded a third candidate, Nigel Bainbridge, but he admitted openly that he only hoped to save his deposit. Alf Abbott felt assured enough to challenge Simon to a public debate. Although it was usual for the sitting member to refuse to be drawn on such occasions, Simon jumped at his opponent's challenge and prepared for the encounter with his usual diligence. 7 days before the election, Simon and Elizabeth stood in the wings behind the stage of Coventry Town Hall with Alf Abbott, Nigel Bainbridge, and their wives. The 3 men made stilted conversation while the women eyed each other's outfits critically. The political correspondent of the Coventry Evening Telegraph, acting as chairman, introduced each of the protagonists as they walked onto the stage, to whipped up applause from different sections of the hall. Simon spoke first, and held the attention of the large audience for over 20 minutes. Those who tried to heckle him ended up regretting having brought attention to themselves. Without once referring to his notes, he quoted figures and clauses from government bills with an ease that impressed even Elizabeth. Abbott followed him and made a bitter attack on the Tories, accusing them of still wanting to tread down the workers at any cost, and was greeted by large cheers from his section of the audience. Bainbridge claimed that neither understood the real issues, and went into an involved dissertation on the problem of the local sewers. During the questions that followed, Simon once again proved to be far better informed than Abbott or Bainbridge. But he was aware that the packed hall only held 700 that cold March evening, while elsewhere in Coventry were 50,000 more voters, most of them glued to Coronation Street. Although the local press proclaimed Simon the victor of a one-sided debate, he remained downcast by the national dailies, which were now predicting a landslide for Labour. On election morning, Simon and Elizabeth were up by 6 and among the first to cast their votes at the local primary school. They spent the rest of the day travelling from polling station to committee room to party checking posts, trying to keep up the morale of their supporters. Everywhere they went, the committed believed in his victory. But Simon knew that the national swing would be impossible to ignore. A senior Conservative backbencher had once told him that an outstanding member could be worth 1,000 personal votes, and a weak opponent might sacrifice another 1,000. It wasn't going to be enough. By 9 o'clock, the last polling station had been locked, and Simon and Elizabeth collapsed into a local pub and ordered 2 halves of bitter. They sat and watched the television above the bar. The commentator was saying that during the day, a straw poll had been taken outside 6 constituencies in London, and from those figures, they were predicting a Labour majority of 60 to 70 seats. Up on the screen flashed the 70 seats most vulnerable to siege by Labour. 9th on the list was Coventry Central. Simon ordered the other half.
"We should be off to watch the count soon," said Elizabeth.
"There's no hurry."
"Don't be such a wimp, Simon. And remember, you're still the member," she said surprisingly sharply. "You owe it to your supporters to remain confident after all the work they've put in."
In the town hall, black boxes were being delivered by police vehicles from every ward in the constituency. Their contents were tipped onto the trestle tables, which made up 3 sides of a square on the vast cleared floor. The town clerk and his personal staff stood alone in the well made by the tables, while council workers sat around the outside, carefully stacking up the votes into little piles of 100. These in turn were checked by party scrutineers, who hovered over them hawk-like, often demanding that a particular 100 be rechecked. The little piles grew into large stacks, which were then placed next to each other, and as the hours passed, it became obvious, even to a casual observer, that the outcome was going to be extremely close. The tension on the floor mounted as each 100, then each 1,000, was handed over to the clerk. Rumours that began at one end of the room had been puffed up like souffles long before they'd reached the waiting crowd standing in a chill wind outside the hall. By midnight, several constituencies' results around the country had been declared. The national swing seemed to be much as predicted, around 3% to Labour, which would give them the promised majority of 70 or over. At 12:21, the Coventry town clerk invited all the 3 candidates to join him in the centre of the room. He told them the result of the count. A recount was immediately demanded. The town clerk agreed, and each pile of voting slips was returned to the tables and checked over again. An hour later, the town clerk called the 3 candidates together again and briefed them on the result of the recount. It had changed by only 3 votes. Another recount was requested, and the town clerk reluctantly acquiesced. By 2 o'clock in the morning, Elizabeth felt she had no nails left. Another hour passed, during which Heath conceded defeat, while Wilson gave an extended interview to ITN, spelling out his programme for the new parliament. At 2:27, the town clerk called the 3 candidates together for the last time, and they all accepted the result. The town clerk walked up onto the stage, accompanied by the rivals. He tapped the microphone to check the speaker was working, cleared his throat, and said,
"I, the undersigned, being the acting returning officer for the constituency of Coventry Central, hereby announce the total number of votes cast for each candidate to be as follows. Alf Abbott, 19,716. Nigel Bainbridge, 7,002. Simon Carslake, 19,731. I therefore declare Simon Carslake to be the duly elected Member of Parliament for the constituency of Coventry Central.
Even though the Labour Party ended up with an overall majority in the House of 97, Simon had still won by 15 votes.
Raymond Gould increased his majority to 12,413, in line with the national swing, and Joyce was ready for a week's rest. Andrew Fraser improved his vote by 2,468 and announced his engagement to Louise Forsyth on the night after the election. Charles Seymour could never recall accurately the size of his majority because, as Fiona explained to the old Earl the following morning, they don't count the Conservative vote in Sussex Downs, darling. They weigh it.
Chapter 6. In most democratic countries, a newly elected leader enjoys a transitional period, during which he's able to announce the policies he intends to pursue and whom he's selected to implement them. In Britain, MPs sit by their phones and wait for 48 hours immediately after the election result has been declared. If a call comes in the first 12 hours, they'll be asked to join the cabinet. The second 12, given a position as a Minister of State. The third 12, made an Under-Secretary of State. And the last 12, a Parliamentary Private Secretary to a Cabinet Minister. If the phone hasn't rung by then, they remain on the back benches. Andrew Fraser had not bothered to be anywhere near a phone when the BBC Midday News announced that Hugh Mackenzie had been promoted from Minister of State to Secretary of State for Scotland, with a seat in the Cabinet. Andrew and Louise Forsyth decided to spend a quiet weekend at Aviemore, he to relax and climb other mountains before returning to the House, she to make plans for their forthcoming wedding. It had taken Andrew countless trips to Edinburgh to convince Louise what had happened to him at Bute House that night did not mean a mere infatuation that would soon pass, but held long-term conviction. When, the one weekend he couldn't travel to the Scottish capital, and she came down to London, he knew she no longer doubted his resolve. Andrew had found in the past that once the conquest was achieved, interest soon waned. For him, though, his love for the wee slip of a thing, as his mother had come to describe Louise, grew and grew. Although Louise was only 5'3", she was so slim she appeared far taller, and her short black hair, blue eyes, and laughing smile had many tall men bending down to take a closer look. "You eat like a pig and look like a rake. I don't know how you manage it," grumbled Andrew over dinner one night. He played regular games of squash and swam 3 times a week to keep his own heavy frame in trim. He stared in admiration, and not a little envy, as Louise's eyes twinkled mischievously before she devoured another portion of Black Forest gatto. Although she had been brought up in a strict Calvinist household in which politics were never discussed, Louise quickly learned about the machinery of government, and soon found herself debating long into the night with Sir Duncan. At first he scored points off her with ease, but it was not long before he had to answer her demands with more and more reasoned arguments, and sometimes even that was not enough. By the time the election had taken place, Louise had become a total convert to Andrew's views. The squalor in some of the parts of the Edinburgh Carlton constituency, which he had never set foot in before, made her sick at heart. Like all converts, she became zealous and began by trying to reform the entire Forsyth clan. She even paid 12 shillings to join the Scottish Labour Party. "Why did you do that?" asked Andrew, trying not to show his pleasure. "I'm against mixed marriages," she replied.
Andrew was delighted, and surprised by the interest she took, and the local constituency's suspicions of the wealthy lady soon turned to affection.
"Your future husband will be Secretary of State for Scotland one day,"
many of them shouted as she walked down the narrow cobbled streets.
"It's Downing Street, not Bute House, that I want to live in," he had once confided to her. "And in any case, I've still got to become a junior minister."
"That could change in the very near future."
"Not while Hugh Mackenzie is Secretary of State," he said, not under his breath.
"To hell with Mackenzie," she said. "Surely one of his cabinet colleagues has the guts to offer you the chance to be his PPS?
But, despite Louise's sentiments, the phone did not ring that weekend. Raymond Gould returned from Leeds the moment the count was over, leaving Joyce to carry out the traditional thank-you drive round the constituency. When he wasn't sitting by the phone the following day, he was walking round it, nervously pushing his glasses back up his nose. The first call came from his mother, who had rung to congratulate him.
"On what?" he asked. "Have you heard something?"
"No, love," she said. "I just rang to say how pleased I was about your increased majority."
"Oh,
and to add how sorry we were not to see you before you left the constituency, especially as you have to pass the shop on the way to the A1.
"Not again, Mother," he wanted to say.
The second call was from a colleague inquiring if Raymond had been offered a job.
"Nothing so far,"
he said before learning of his contemporary's promotion.
The third call was from one of Joyce's friends.
"When will she be back?"
another Yorkshire accent inquired.
"I have no idea,"
said Raymond, desperate to get the caller off the line.
"I'll call again this afternoon, then."
"Fine," said Raymond, putting the phone down quickly. He went into the kitchen to make himself a cheese sandwich, but there wasn't any cheese, so he ate stale bread smeared with 3-week-old butter. He was halfway through a second slice when the phone rang.
"Raymond?"
He held his breath.
"Noel Brewster."
He exhaled in exasperation as he recognized the vicar's voice.
"Can you read the second lesson when you're next up in Leeds? We had rather hoped you'd read it this morning. Your dear wife..."
"Yes," he promised. "The first weekend I'm back in Leeds."
The phone rang again as soon as he placed it back on the receiver.
"Raymond Gould?" said an anonymous voice.
"Speaking,"
he said.
"The Prime Minister will be with you in one moment."
Raymond waited.
The front door opened, and another voice shouted,
"It's only me. I don't suppose you found anything to eat, poor love."
Joyce joined Raymond in the drawing room. Without looking at his wife, he waved his hand at her to keep quiet.
"Ray,"
said a voice on the other end of the line.
"Good afternoon, Prime Minister,"
he replied, rather formally in response to the more pronounced Yorkshire accent.
"I was hoping you would feel able to join the new team as Under-Secretary for Employment."
Raymond breathed a sigh of relief. It was exactly what he'd hoped for.
"I'd be delighted, Prime Minister."
"Good. That'll give the trade union leader something new to think about."
The phone went dead. Raymond Gould, Under-Secretary of State at the Department of Employment, sat motionless on the third rung of the ladder. As Raymond left the house the next morning, he was greeted by a driver standing next to a gleaming black Austin Westminster. Unlike his second-hand sunbeam, it glowed in the morning light. The rear door was opened, and Raymond climbed in to be driven off to the department. "Thank God he knows where my office is," thought Raymond as he sat alone in the back. By his side on the back seat was a red leather box the size of a very thick briefcase, with gold lettering running along the edge. Under-Secretary of State for Employment. Raymond turned the small key, knowing what Alice must have felt like on her way down the rabbit hole. The inside was crammed with buff files. He opened the first to see
a 5-point plan for discussion by Cabinet on how to keep unemployment under 1 million. He immediately started to read the closely typed documents. When Charles Seymour returned to the Commons on the Tuesday, there was a note from the Whip's office waiting